You are listening to The Evidence Locker. Thank you for choosing our podcast. Our sponsors make it possible for us to keep bringing you new episodes. Please support them as they have some great deals just for you, our listeners. If you prefer to listen to ad-free content, simply find us on Patreon, where plans start from as little as $2 a month. 25% of these proceeds are donated to the Doe Network, working to bring closure to international cold cases. For more information, follow the link in the show notes. Today's episode is brought to you by Noom, helping people around the world enjoy healthier lives through better nutrition and exercise. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com/evidence locker. This podcast is also sponsored by BetterHelp, the world's largest online counseling platform. Visit BetterHelp.com/evidence to take charge of your mental health with the help of an experienced professional. Our cases deal with true crimes and real people. Some parts are graphic in nature, and listener discretion is advised. Each episode is produced with the utmost respect to the victims, their families, and loved ones. When 36-year-old Lisa Montgomery from Malvern, Kansas, called her husband on December 16, 2004, to let him know she had gone into labor while shopping, Kevin was ecstatic. He wanted a child with his second wife for a long time and gone through several miscarriages, but finally, he would get to hold his baby girl. Kevin Montgomery's happiness, unfortunately, lasted for less than 24 hours before the shocking truth was revealed. He was not the father of baby Abigail, and Lisa was not her mother, but a murdered woman named Bobby Jo Stinnett. Born in Skidmore, Missouri, on December 4, 1981, Bobby Jo Potter was Becky and Buck Potter's only child. She was born with a cleft palate, like one in every 1,700 newborns in the United States. A common congenital defect is caused by the two sides of the palate not fusing together during the development of the fetus. The child with the condition requires several treatments, including surgery and speech therapy, during their lifetime. In Bobby Jo's case, she underwent surgery when she was 2 years old. And not just for the cleft palate. Unfortunately, severe ear infections also caused problems and excruciating pain for the little girl. And eventually, as other treatments failed, tubes were surgically inserted into Bobby Joe's ears. But despite all the health issues, Bobby Jo was a sweet child, whose speech difficulties were a charming feature rather than a stumbling block. A family friend, Cheryl Houston, recalled years later, with a smile on her face, how Bobby Jo one day wanted to sit between her and her mother, saying, "I want to sit in the miggle." Meanwhile, Becky and Buck's marriage was on the rocks. Around the time Bobby Jo was still a small child, her father moved to Texas and left the family behind. Becky and Bobby Jo did join him later, but the reunion was short-lived. Buck was not exactly a family man. He did not pay attention to his wife and daughter, nor did he provide for them. Eventually, Becky had had enough, took Bobby Jo, and returned to Skidmore as a single parent. Skidmore is a tiny town in western Nottoway County, situated at the junction of Missouri Highway 113 and Route DD, with a population of just around 280. While houses are cheap, that is basically where the good things about town end. In the last 100 years, half of the residents of Skidmore have either moved away or died. There have been very few that have actually wanted to relocate to the little town that is said to be cursed. You may recall the name Skidmore, as Evidence Locker episode 136, The Vigilante Killing of Ken Rex McElroy, also took place in this town. McElroy held the title of town bully because he used Skidmore as his personal playground for 2 decades, raping and plundering before he was gunned down while surrounded by a mob of local citizens. The incident took place just months before the birth of Bobby Jo Potter on July 10, 1981. Curiously, not a single one of more than 50 witnesses cooperated with the police, and the identity of the person who actually pulled the trigger on Ken has remained a mystery to this day. Many years later, in October 2000, a local woman named Mary Gillenwater was stomped to death by her boyfriend, Greg Dragoo. Mary's grandmother, Jo Ann Stinnett, happened to be Bobby Jo's aunt. And a boy named Branson Perry, who vanished without a trace on April 11, 2001, was Bobby Joe's cousin. So you could say Skidmore has a certain kind of aura. The crime rate in the tiny town is low throughout, but when something happens, it is peculiar and grisly. And in that corner of the world, Becky Potter tried to offer Bobby Joe the best life possible. There were not exactly many job opportunities in the town, but fortunately, Cheryl was able to talk to her mother and give Becky a job at a store and a paycheck to support her and her little girl. Bobby Joe's parents' divorce was finalized in 1985, and in around the time she became a teenager, her mother married again and soon welcomed another child to the family, a son named Tyler. Even though Bobby Joe had been shy for most of her life, mainly because of other children ridiculing her speech impediment, she grew up to be a confident, popular, and successful young woman. During her time at Nodaway Holt High School in Graham, Missouri, Bobby Joe participated in the 4-H Club, worked on the school newspaper, became a cheerleader, and excelled as an honor student. The teenager also loved animals, especially horses, and enjoyed barrel riding. Bobby Joe had a talent to really connect with the animal and work together to achieve a common goal. Bobby Joe graduated in the spring of 2000 and began working at Earl May Feed and Supply in April of 2001. According to her supervisor, Chuck Ellis, Bobby Joe was a dream employee, dependable and flexible, always ready to help others. While Bobby Joe enjoyed gardening and developed the knowledge of all the store's products, what she really loved to do was to take care of the pet corner. Eventually, Chuck made Bobby Joe responsible for ordering small animals like bunnies, gerbils, rats, mice, and guinea pigs for the store. The young woman often told her boss and her co-workers about her aspirations of becoming a rat terrier breeder. It did not take long for that dream to come true. On January 17, 2002, Bobby Joe's first dog, 7-year-old Tipsy, gave birth to her first litter. All but one of those puppies Bobby Joe sold under her business called Happy Haven Farms. Bobby Joe was a very responsible breeder who carefully selected who was allowed to adopt her puppies. Each prospective owner had to fill out a 2-page application from going into details of their household, how much time they had for a dog, and if they were planning to take the puppy to obedience class. Soon, Bobby Joe's way of doing business earned respect in the rat terrier community, and other breeders began to contact her for advice. Bobby Joe was especially focused on the genetic factors of breeding, which was fueled by the fact that she had been born with a birth defect. But no matter how much knowledge Bobby Joe had, or how much others looked up to her, she always stayed modest, and often mentioned in her messages that learning never ended. In 2003, Bobby Joe left her job at Earl May after accepting a position at the Kawasaki plant, a major employer in Nodaway County, where her boyfriend, Zeb Stinnett, step-grandson of Joanne Stinnett, also worked. Bobby Joe and Zeb had grown up in the same neighborhood, and unsurprisingly for a small town, had known each other since they were children. The young couple married on April 26, 2003, before renting a small bungalow on Elm Street. The Stinnett's dream was to buy their own house one day, and so the money that Bobby Joe made from breeding dogs was stashed away. At the time, there was no reason in the world to think the couple would not achieve their goals. Around this time, Bobby Joe was a familiar face at dog shows. In addition to showing the dogs in the ring, she had become a licensed judge for the National Kennel Club, a rat terrier breed inspector, and press secretary for a United Kennel Club. Sometimes, Bobby Joe traveled to exhibitions sharing a hotel room with another breeder, Tracy Ramirez or Zeb, who was not involved in the business but supported his wife's passion. During one of these dog show events, Bobby Joe met a woman named Lisa Marie Montgomery. Born in Washington State on February 27, 1968, Lisa was the firstborn of John and Judy Hedberg, having a younger sister, Patty. Described as a smart little thing, Lisa never really had an interest in playing with dolls. Instead, she read books since she was 4 years old. Judy later said that her daughter was so engrossed in a book at times that the house could burn down and she wouldn't even smell the smoke. Perhaps, as a result of reading stories all the time, Lisa developed a habit of telling tall tales. For example, when her parents separated, Lisa went around telling everyone her father had died in Vietnam. After the divorce, Judy struggled to provide for her 2 young children for a while, but then she met a single father of 5, Jack Kleiner, and all 9 of them moved together to Oklahoma. The children kept coming as the family welcomed Lisa's half-brothers, Teddy and Jerry, in 1974 and 1975. A few months later, in October 1975, Judy and Jack married. Their 3rd and final child, Tommy, was born in 1978. Despite her rather annoying habit of telling lies, Lisa was initially doing quite well. She continued reading and learning. She played violin and French horn in grade school and mellophone in the high school marching band. It also appeared that Lisa did not have to make much effort to get A's and B's. Still, Judy saw something in her daughter that worried her. At times, it seemed like Lisa switched personalities. In a blink of an eye, she could turn from a sweet, caring child to the daughter of the devil itself. At first, Judy assured herself it was all because of the normal phases a child went through. But eventually, she began to fear what kind of person Lisa would grow to be. However, those who know Judy and Lisa blame the mother for her daughter's issues. Apparently, Judy did not offer any kind of stability for her children, not to mention security or motherly love. Her moods were swift to change, and so was the way she treated Lisa and her siblings. Sadly, having Jack as a parent added fuel to the fire of an already bad situation. Sometime in February 1983, Judy returned home and found her husband and 15-year-old daughter in bed together, engaged in sexual intercourse. Judy was not just sickened, but terrified. Jack Kleiner was a violent man and threatened to kill her if she told anyone about what she had seen. This man, a father that had just sexually abused his stepdaughter, allegedly told Judy, "You can't rape the willing." The disturbing thing is that this was not the first time. For years, Jack had hit and knocked around Judy and the children and used them sexually as he pleased. Judy later claimed that she had been blind all that time and did not know the extent of her husband's acts. Others say she chose to ignore the abuse, but after she found her husband in bed with her daughter, she realized she had to leave him and finally filed for a divorce. Jack, of course, denied everything in court, and Lisa told a counselor she had never slept with her stepfather, even though they had been caught in the act. The thing is, Jack had threatened Lisa too, saying he would go after her sister Patty if she told anyone about the sexual abuse. Lisa had no choice but to keep her mouth shut. In early 1986, Judy married her third husband, a man named Richard Bowman, whose son, 25-year-old Carl, then began to date his 18-year-old stepsister. Lisa graduated from high school the same year and planned to join the Air Force to get money for college. However, when Lisa found out she was pregnant, those plans were abandoned and she married Carl in August of 1986. While Lisa resented her mother and longed for everything Judy never provided, including normalcy, stability, and security, Lisa seemed to follow in her mother's footsteps in life. Within the next 4 years, Lisa and Carl had three daughters and a son, Desiree Nicole, Chelsea Lynn, Carl James Bowman II, or CJ, and Kayla Deanna. After their fourth child's birth in 1990, Carl pressured Lisa to undergo a tubal litigation so that it could be sure there would be no more children. Lisa, however, felt like she was losing control. In her mind, being pregnant had a way to ensure that Carl did not leave her, no matter how serious their marital problems were. And yet Lisa did not exactly provide the best possible home for the children produced in the process. The Bowman household was filthy, and Lisa was known for sometimes feeding lunch to her children on the floor. In the end, Carl could not handle Lisa's lackadaisical attitude, among other problems, and filed for divorce in October 1993. He even moved states away to Springdale, Arkansas, but Lisa took the children and followed him. At the end of the year, Lisa then told Carl she was pregnant again despite her tubes being tied. Carl may have been suspicious, but he also knew the procedure could have failed. And so Lisa and Carl got back together and tried to make their relationship work. Apparently, the couple found some help from the Fayetteville Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints, and eventually remarried in a service there on June 11, 1994. Meanwhile, Lisa's pregnancy simply disappeared, but not for long. Around the end of the year, Lisa began talking to her family and friends about being pregnant with twins. This time, Carl knew for sure his wife was making it up. Judy was also convinced her daughter was lying just like she had been doing all her life. Judy had been at the hospital when Lisa had her tubes tied. Not for a second did she believe pregnancy was possible. Unsurprisingly, as the months passed, there was still no baby, and talk of pregnancy again vanished into thin air. At some point, the family moved to Deming, New Mexico, where Carl worked as a delivery driver for a restaurant, and Lisa was hired by the local newspaper, The Headlight, as an inserter and route supervisor. At home, Lisa kept chickens and goats and taught her children how to process the wool. But Lisa lacked interest in the household tasks. Carl supervisor Bill Boomhauer once described the home by saying, "You could barely walk through the place. The only time the place got clean was when Carl did it. Teachers at the Sunshine School would take care of the children and bring in clean clothes for them." In the end, Lisa ran out of tricks to hold her marriage together. In 1998, Carl left with all four children and settled in Bartlesville, Oklahoma. In turn, Lisa moved to Kansas to live with her mother. By that time, Judy had a new husband. This time, a man named Danny Shaughnessy. Lisa, too, did not remain single for a long time. In 1999, she met Kevin Montgomery and began to weave her web of lies once again. Lisa and Kevin began dating soon after they met for the first time, working together in Topeka. The two had only been together for a short time when Lisa pulled one of her old tricks and told Kevin she was pregnant. Likely, Lisa had hoped the news would result in Kevin proposing to her, but instead, he gave her money for an abortion. That money, of course, was used for something else. As her first lie had not worked, Lisa then told Kevin a story, perhaps for sympathy. Lisa claimed that she had gotten pregnant during her teenage years and had given birth to a baby who the doctors claimed was dead. In truth, Lisa told Kevin the baby girl had survived and had been put up for adoption behind her back. Lisa said that she grew suspicious years later and eventually tracked down the adoptive parents and learned her taken daughter had been given the name Sarah. Not a single word of Lisa's tale was true, but Kevin believed her. Why would she lie about something like that? Eventually, the couple married in March 2000 despite the fact Kevin had gone through a messy divorce a short time before. As the court had given Lisa full custody of her children, her three daughters and son moved in with the newlyweds to a rural farmhouse in Osage County. But every time Kevin's three sons visited them on the weekend, the little house was so packed they eventually had to move to a bigger home in Isabel Felon. In addition to once again enjoying raising livestock and spinning wool into yarn, Lisa spent her time on the internet. She absolutely loved it. Often, Lisa would ask for advice, like in this post. "I am hoping to learn how to knit a pair of socks with some of it, but my kids have already asked for mittens. Since it is white, I should be able to dye it, so here's another question. Is it better to dye the wool or the already spun yarn?" Lisa would also write about her children. "I had four kids a year apart. They learn cooperation, manners, and are closer than they were before. As they are all in high school now, we have plans when they all graduate that our next ones will be homeschooled for the first couple of years." So Lisa planned to have more children. People in the community had seen her a million times appearing to be pregnant, but then Lisa would announce she had miscarried again. It did not happen just once or twice. Lisa even claimed that she donated one of the fetuses to science. At this point, Kevin also wanted children and had to go through all the fake losses, while Lisa never told him about the tubal ligation. Still, she told her minister, Reverend Mike Wheatley of the First Church of God, that when she would have a child with Kevin, she would be attached at the hip to her husband. According to the Reverend, Lisa never talked about anything else than her family and her children, and was not interested in hearing about other people in their lives. Lisa would just cut them off and continue talking about her world. Then, around 2002, Lisa found a new hobby. She started to breed rat terriers, and by June 2003, she already had three dogs and was active in the online community. It was through one of the forums that Lisa got to know another breeder, a man named Jason Dawson. Lisa and Jason eventually met several times to breed their dogs or transport puppies. Jason later said that he did not exactly enjoy Lisa's company. "There was something just plain odd about her, but I couldn't put my finger on it." Lisa also caused outrage in the rat terrier community as another breeder, Nancy Strudel, accused her of misrepresenting the pedigree of her dogs. Pretty much everybody wanted Lisa to be kicked out of their group, but there was one person who defended her. Respected breeder, Bobby Joe Stinnett. Thanks to Bobby's reputation, Lisa was given a second chance. In the fall of 2003, Lisa was once again telling everyone she was pregnant, somehow hoping that her image as an expectant mother would help her win custody of her half-brother Teddy's son, who had been sent to prison for drug-related charges. Many believe Lisa actually tipped off the authorities, and that was the only reason Teddy got caught. But in the end, Lisa's plan did not work out as baby Justin was given to her mother. If Lisa had been desperate before, now it began to get out of hand. After realizing she could just buy a baby, Lisa contacted her ex-husband Carl and his new wife Vanessa and demanded $45,000 in cash. Apparently, Lisa had heard Vanessa's father had died and she was about to get a large inheritance. Needless to say, the couple denied the request, which resulted in Lisa harassing them and threatening to destroy Vanessa. The horrified Vanessa later spoke to the London Mail saying, We were really concerned about what was going to happen because we couldn't afford to give her money even if we wanted to. I was convinced she was going to do something dreadful, and I thought Carl and I were in danger. Vanessa was not far from the truth, but they were not the ones in danger. When Lisa then once again began to act pregnant, Patty and Judy had had enough. First, Lisa's sister told Kevin that his wife had a tubal ligation in 1990, and therefore could not physically be pregnant. A week later, Judy visited Kevin's parents and told them the truth, but the allegations were not taken seriously. Instead of believing Judy and Patty, the Montgomerys trusted Lisa, who had said her family just wanted to hurt her. As you can guess, Lisa was furious and even tried to get a restraining order prohibiting her mother and sister from seeing her children. And when that request was rejected, Lisa filed a court order so that Judy and Patty would no longer be allowed to tell people that she faked pregnancies. Lisa's behavior was so alarming that Judy consulted lawyers about the possibility of involuntarily admitting her to a psychiatric institution. Unfortunately, that was not possible unless Lisa harmed herself or someone else. Then it could be too late. Meanwhile, Lisa continued her life as if everything was just fine. In April of 2004, she went to a dog show with her daughter Kayla and happened to meet face-to-face the breeder who had defended her online, Bobby Joe, who was now pregnant with her first child. At that moment, Lisa Montgomery became pregnant too. Now, Lisa and Bobby Joe did not just bond over their shared love for rat terriers, but because they were both expecting a baby. Or so Bobby Joe thought. After the show, the two women began chatting online and exchanging emails. They talked about dogs and breeding in addition to pregnancy progress and future dreams. Bobby Joe's baby was due in January 2015, and she was absolutely ecstatic. She and Zeb had already decided that if the baby was a boy, it would be named Zebediah, and if a girl, it would be Victoria Joe. By early November, it was confirmed that they would soon welcome a baby girl into the world. Bobby Joe often talked about her hopes and dreams for her daughter. She wanted to take Victoria Joe with her to dog shows as soon as possible and teach her everything she knew. That same month, Bobby Joe's friends threw a baby shower for her, celebrating the new life. Meanwhile, Lisa bought a home birth kit and downloaded directions from MapQuest, showing the route from her home in Malvern to the home of Bobby Joe in Skidmore. Lisa also quit her job at Wendy's before Thanksgiving. She told her boss her baby was due in December, and therefore she needed to slow down. On December 15th, Bobby Joe, who was 8 months pregnant at this point, was contacted by a woman named Darlene Fisher via Instant Messenger. "I was recommended to you by Jason Dawson and have been unable to reach you by either phone or email. Please get in touch with me as soon as we are considering the purchase of one of your puppies." Within the next 20 minutes, Bobby Joe and Darlene had made plans to meet the very next day. Bobby Joe was excited. She loved her work as a breeder and would have a great time showing off her puppies. At 2:30 p.m. on December 16th, Bobby Joe's mother called asking if she could pick her up from work at Sumi Oil. Just then, Bobby Joe heard a knock on the door and saw a red Toyota parked in front of her house. Telling her mother she could not leave the house yet, she hung up and went to the door. But to Billy Joe's surprise, the woman who stood on her front porch was not a stranger. It was Lisa Montgomery. We do not know what thoughts went through Bobby Joe's mind at that moment. Perhaps she did not recognize Lisa, or she had come up with some kind of excuse to be there. Nevertheless, the result was the same. Bobby Joe invited Lisa inside her home and led her to the converted bedroom that housed the litter of rat terriers. In a moment, when Bobby Joe turned her back to Lisa, she wrapped a rope around her neck and jerked it tight. But Bobby Joe fought for her and her baby's lives, kicking her attacker and clawing at the rope. But Lisa was too strong. Eventually, the young mother-to-be slumped over and slid to the floor. It was then that Lisa ran to the kitchen, grabbed a 3-inch paring knife, and returned to the bedroom where she knelt on the floor next to Bobby Joe. Lisa's next actions were unimaginable. She raised the knife and sliced the young woman's stomach open carefully. But Bobby Joe was not dead yet. Such pain was enough to revive her, and again Bobby Joe fought. She threw off her attacker and knocked away the knife while blood poured from the wound on her belly. Lisa and Bobby Joe struggled, resulting in cuts all over their hands and Lisa losing strands of her hair that were pulled out by the roots. But in the end, Lisa was able to secure the rope again around Bobby Joe's neck, and this time, she did not let go before she was sure that all life was gone, except the babies. For 5 minutes, Lisa held the rope before finally letting Bobby Joe's body slide back to the floor. She then picked up the knife and continued cutting through the layers of skin, fat, and muscle on Bobby Joe's stomach before she reached what she had come for. Lisa sliced Bobby Joe's womb open and pulled out a crying baby girl. After cutting the umbilical cord and wrapping the baby in a blanket, Lisa took the knife and ran to her car. Somewhere between Skidmore and Topeka, Lisa cleaned herself and the baby up before calling Kevin to tell him the news. He was the father of a brand new, healthy baby girl. Meanwhile, Becky finished her shift and was surprised not to see her daughter. So Becky called Bobby Joe at 3:30 p.m., but there was no answer. As Becky's workplace was located just a few blocks from the Stinnett's house, she decided to walk there just to see what was going on. Becky felt a bit strange finding the front door open, and that feeling just got worse as she walked into the quiet house. She called out for Bobby Joe, but she did not answer. It was then that Becky walked into the most horrific scene one could imagine. Her 23-year-old daughter lay on the floor in a pool of blood. Becky immediately dialed 911 and explained to the dispatcher it looked like her 8-month pregnant daughter's stomach had exploded. When paramedics and police arrived at the scene, Bobby Joe Stinnett was pronounced dead. To everybody's horror, the closer examination showed that her baby was no longer inside her body. Someone had forcibly removed it from Bobby Joe's womb. But could the baby still be alive? At the time of Bobby Joe's death, Amber Alert had never been issued for an unborn baby, as the alert requires a description of the victim, among other specific details. However, in this case, the investigators fought hard, and after intervention by Congressman Sam Graves, the alert was implemented. Becky and Zeb both told the authorities that Bobby Joe was due to meet a woman named Darlene that day, as she wanted to purchase a puppy. Other than that, nobody knew who could have gotten into the home and butchered Bobby Joe. Thanks to the digital evidence, the police quickly recovered the IP address of a person who had been talking with Bobby Joe through emails. But even though the messages were signed with the name Darlene, the IP address belonged to Lisa Montgomery. The following day, on December 17, 2004, police went to Lisa's farmhouse in Melvern, Kansas. Immediately, they saw a car that matched the witness description, and inside the home, they discovered Lisa sitting on a couch, watching television with a newborn baby in her arms. As the officers asked Lisa about the baby, who she called Abigail, she claimed she had given birth at a woman's clinic in Topeka. However, when asked the same question outside without Kevin being present, Lisa said that due to financial difficulties, she had had the baby at home but did not want to tell her husband. At this point, Lisa had an explanation for everything. She even told the officers she had thrown the placenta in a nearby creek. But eventually, perhaps fearing Kevin's reaction, Lisa asked if the conversation could continue at the sheriff's office. In custody, Lisa Montgomery confessed to strangling Bobby Joe Stinnett and cutting the baby from her womb. DNA testing then confirmed that the baby was indeed Victoria Joe, Zeb and Bobby Joe's daughter. Fortunately, despite the horribly violent manner of how Victoria Joe was delivered and the fact that she was born a month too early, she was in surprisingly good health and was released after a short time to her father's care. Lisa was charged on the federal level with kidnapping resulting in death. If convicted, she could be sentenced to death, which is a very rare sentence for a female offender in the United States. The case went to trial in 2008, with little to no question as to Lisa's guilt. She had literally been found holding Victoria Joe a day after Billy Joe's death. The investigators had also uncovered a mound of evidence of Lisa planning her heinous crime, creating profiles under a fake name and posing as Darlene, and arranging to meet Bobby Joe. In addition, Lisa had been watching videos online on how to perform a cesarean section. Of course, Lisa's defense brought up her difficult childhood and mental and sexual abuse. The defense also argued Lisa had been born with fetal alcohol syndrome and sustained brain injuries during car accidents during her life. Nobody can deny Lisa Montgomery had issues, and she was unsurprisingly diagnosed in prison with bipolar disorder, dissociative disorder, psychosis, and post-traumatic stress disorder. Lisa, whose twisted view of reality led to a tragedy. But the extent of her mental illnesses was not fully revealed until after the trial. On October 22, 2007, the jury returned with a guilty verdict, rejecting the defense's claim that Lisa was delusional. 4 days later, the jury recommended the death sentence. Despite numerous appeals and a petition to President Donald Trump for clemency, Lisa Montgomery was executed by lethal injection on January 13th, 2021, at a prison in Terre Haute, Indiana. No final words were spoken. While that day gave closure and relief to Bobby Joe Stinnett's family, there were those who strongly opposed Lisa's execution. Some believed Lisa Montgomery's issues were so deep she was completely out of touch with reality and thus mentally incompetent, making a case for not executing her. But many more disagree, especially those who were present that day 16 years ago, who saw Bobby Joe's body or heard her mother's cries. Today, Victoria Jo Stinnett is a healthy teenager, still living in the Skidmore area with her family. People may not agree with the execution of Lisa Montgomery, but nothing in her past justified leaving a child without her mother and having to live every birthday remembering that her mother was brutally killed just for her to be born. We'd like to thank today's sponsors, Noom and BetterHelp. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom Weight's psychology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com/evidence locker. That is Noom, Noom.com/evidence locker. And to get unstuck, reach out to your own online therapist. Visit BetterHelp.com/evidence today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp.com/evidence. If you'd like to read more about this case, have a look at the resources used for this episode in the show notes. Also, visit us on social media to see more about today's case. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also check out our channel on YouTube. If you like what we do here at Evidence Locker, subscribe on Apple Podcast or wherever you are listening right now, and kindly leave a 5-star review. This was the Evidence Locker. Thank you for listening.